All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah, and I'm just going to get juiced up here a little bit by listening to this song and getting ready to talk with you. We got a great show for you today. At the back end of the show, we have a very special segment. Jose Montoya, one of the great poets in the world and especially one of the great Chicano poets, a man who's often been known as the father of Chicano poetry and whose whole life and his heart has been dedicated to telling the stories of the Chicano people and bringing them out to the world. Now, Jose Montoya died on September 25th of this year, and I wanted to mark that death in a special way. So we're going to be listening to an interview I did with Jose Montoya back in 2007. And that's about the best way I could think of to say goodbye to Jose Montoya. But before that, there was a film that I saw that just knocked me back in my seat. It's called Let the Fire Burn, and it's a film about the assault on the MOVE organization in Philadelphia. Now, MOVE is a radical black back-to-nature kind of organization based in Philadelphia. A lot of their members came from the Black Panther Party, a lot of the people who were influenced by the Black Panther Party, and back in 1976 began a whole, decade-long confrontation between the members of the MOVE organization and the Philadelphia police, especially its racist, fascistic mayor, Frank Rizzo. And the movie follows MOVE from 1978, when their house in Powhatan Village was surrounded by the Philadelphia Police Department, and the Philadelphia police just unloaded a whole barrage full of weapons. One cop was killed, some firemen were injured. But in the end, what happened was 9 MOVE members were indicted and convicted of killing the cop, even though every gun in the MOVE house was incapable of firing, of working. They didn't have a firing pin. So that began a whole, crusade that the Philadelphia authorities and beyond them, that the system brought down on the MOVE organization. And it culminated on May 13th, 1985, when the Philadelphia police and the Philadelphia authorities dropped a bomb on another house occupied by members of the MOVE organization. Now, this film is just really incredible, and I'm not going to say a whole lot more about it. I'm going to let the film and the interview I did with director Jason Osder tell its own story, all right? So this is my conversation with Jason Osder, the director of the film Let the Fire Burn.
May 13th, 1985, years of conflict between the city of Philadelphia and a small urban group known as MOVE ended in a violent day-long encounter. It was one of the most devastating days in the modern history of this city.
The big story tonight is the effort to evict MOVE. The effort has turned into a disaster.
Can you describe the philosophy of MOVE?
We were being taught about the corruption in this system.
The system, the establishment, you.
Did you consider the MOVE organization to be a terrorist group?
People who threaten to shoot and kill neighbors, police.
I think that's a pretty adequate description of the word terrorist.
Where is it written that we could not have a religion of our own?
The system had one intention, to either kill MOVE people or to put us in prison as long as possible. It's just that simple.
More than 3 dozen Philadelphia policemen surrounded the building after a MOVE member was spotted on the roof wearing a hooded mask and carrying a shotgun.
We intend to seize control of the house. We will do it by any means necessary.
Every one of us knew that someone was going to die.
Did you have a concern that the people inside that house might be in physical danger?
Excuse me.
Yes, ma'am.
Ask me. Well, what we concerned is complete insanity.
There has just been a huge explosion here. We don't know what it means, but it just shook the whole place. It was a huge blast.
Did it ever occur to you that this might have been a dangerous device?
Yes, ma'am.
The fire got real heavy. We couldn't breathe. Then that's when we started yelling.
What did you say? What did you yell?
We want to come out.
There's no one that I know in city government that would intentionally go out there to burn those people to death. There's no one that I know of could do that.
I remember as soon as I scooped him up, he said to me, "Don't shoot me, don't shoot me."
In the astonishingly gripping Let the Fire Burn, director Jason Osder has crafted that rarest of cinematic objects, a found footage film that unfurls with the tension of a great thriller, On May 13, 1985, a longtime feud between the city of Philadelphia and the black nationalist group MOVE came to a deadly climax. By order of the local authorities, police dropped military-grade explosives onto a MOVE-occupied row house. TV cameras captured the conflagration that quickly escalated and resulted in the murder of 11 people, including 5 children, and the destruction of 61 homes. It was only later discovered that authorities decided to, quote, let the fire burn. Using only archival news coverage and interviews, first-time filmmaker Osder has brought to life one of the most tumultuous and largely forgotten clashes between government and citizens in modern American history. And joining us to talk about the film Let the Fire Burn is the director of the film, Jason Osder. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Sure. Well, let's jump into it so we can cover as much as we can. What compelled you to make this film?
Well, I was growing up right outside Philadelphia when this happened, and I was 11 years old, and that's roughly the age of some of the children who died in the fire. 5 children died. And, you know, it was obviously a very traumatic as well as tragic event for the whole city, but as a child and at that very influential age, it just really hit me as the first thing from the outside world, the news world, you know, bigger than my family or my school, that sort of, you know, cracked that childhood shell and really shocked and actually frightened me. I mean, you don't have as a child all of the frames of reference that adults use to sort of contextualize these things. So to me, it was just scary. You know, children died in my city. The police were partially responsible. Their parents couldn't help them. I was scared. And it just stuck with me.
You know, as I was telling you a little bit earlier, this is something that really struck me, I was in my 30s when this happened, and thinking about that, when I heard about it, when I saw what was going on, it was so horrifying. And yet, as the years tumbled by, this became one of the most little known and very covered up pieces of history. So you were drawn to it from what impacted you as a child. But then later, as an adult, was there something that really made you want to uncover this?
Well, I was struck by exactly the same thing, and not actually even that long after. So when I left Philadelphia and went away to college, you know, I met a lot of people my own age from different parts of the country. And this thing that had sort of struck me so hard as a child, partly because I, you know, didn't know how to understand it, maybe no one did, but especially as a child, then it, you know, not that many years later, as a young adult, really a teenager, I was struck by the same thing already, that people my own age, you know, I carried this thing with me, and when I brought it up, people just gave me a blank stare, like, what are you talking about? And so, yeah, I mean, I was struck by that as well, fairly young, and then I would say it faded more as time went by.
You know, you chose to do the film in a very unique manner. You chose to use only archival footage, and that was footage of the hearings of the commission that was appointed to investigate the assault on the MOVE house and the murder of the MOVE members. Now, that was the footage that you chose to use to make the film. And two questions now. Why and how hard was it to do that? And that's not just from the artistic standpoint, too. It's from also a question of access to this footage and whatnot.
Yeah, thank you. So why? I really have to, you know, give a lot of credit to the editor of the film, Nels Bangeter. And when we started to work together late in 2010, I'd been collecting this stuff for almost 10 years. And he saw it all together, which included the archival footage we collected, news, also the hearings, the commission hearings that were held, as well as the interviews I'd shot, everything, the photographs, everything we had. And he looked at it all in a period of 2 or 3 weeks. And when we met to talk about how to cut the film, we knew we were sort of looking for some way to make it unique. But what he helped me see was two things. One, that the interviews I'd shot and the subjects to a certain extent had certain problems with them. They weren't that revealing, partly because maybe people had not evolved that much or really didn't have that many more insights. One of the things you do with those interviews is look back and have new insights, but those insights weren't apparent. And then for different reasons, it was hard to sort of get under the surface. What you also want to do in a documentary interview is provide personal insights and emotional insights and get under the surface and see what it meant. And these were hard interviews in that way for a number of reasons. In the case of Ramona Africa, the adult survivor, she's very polished, you know, she's very professional, and she's not trying to project her, you know, emotional inner self. She's speaking for the organization, and she's very good at it. And in the case of Michael Ward, the childhood survivor who tragically actually just died very recently, last month, he was so much like a child as an adult. He had the same mannerisms, he looked down a lot, he mumbled a lot. And to watch the whole interview, it was over 2 hours, you know, I think it really reflected a lot of damage and sort of arrested development, but it wasn't that good cinematically, right? So in a sense, all of the interviews were somewhat flawed or not that revealing. But the hearings, as well as the news footage, but especially the hearings, we had something special. We had the ability with those hearings to provide context and also to move the story forward, but not sort of slow the pace down as you do with a talking head or a narrator, and also not to give primacy to certain voices, which you definitely do with the narrator. But with the talking head also, you're really picking and choosing and setting these people up in an artificial situation. And so we realized we could do what we needed to do, but kind of keep the tension building, because we would never sort of relieve that tension when someone sort of tells you what it's about, makes it easy on the audience. It would stay challenging for the audience, because everyone was always being questioned. And you always would have to question them and sort of lean forward and ask, like, who's telling the truth here? So those were the two reasons that we decided to do it that way. Was it difficult? You know, it maybe wasn't as difficult as you may think it would be. Once it was, you know, making that decision and kind of getting up on the high dive to say, you know, is this a smart thing to do? Artistically, will this pay off? You know, we saw it as risk-reward. We thought going into it, wow, if this concept pays off, it might be a really special film and people might really, really enjoy it in a special way, because they would have to interact with it in a special way. And if it doesn't, we sort of thought there's some risk there, but really just, like, we'd probably know it if it didn't work. You know, it would probably sort of fall on its face and just not be a film at all. So I think once we sort of steeled up the courage to do it that way, a lot of it, from my point of view, sort of fell into place in the normal process. We tried to do, once we decided that that was the rules of this particular film, we tried to do everything else just to cut a good film, just the same way you would do it with a high ratio observational or cinema verite film. We just tried to make it work. And I don't know that it was more or less difficult than doing it in a traditional way.
Here's a question for you. I mean, and let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jason Oster, who's the director of the film Let the Fire Burn, a really great new film about the horrific, savage murder of the of members of the MOVE organization in Philadelphia in 1985 by the Philadelphia police and the Philadelphia authorities. Jason, here's one of the things I wanted to ask you, though, is, like, was it also, in terms of difficulty, was it hard to get access to that material?
Well, yes, that part was hard, and it took a lot of years. And the real breakthrough was when I joined the faculty at the George Washington University School of Media and Public Affairs. And up until that point, I'd really kind of floundered. I mean, I feel like I was just, like, pedaling as hard as I could, but just got no traction. And it was really when I got the institutional support of a university, and that plays out on so many levels, from financial to legal support to sort of clout and at other levels too, just having that intellectual support and being part of an intellectual community, that really was sort of like a key in the lock to being able to access and really deal with people I needed to deal with in order to get access to the footage. But it took a long time, and even with that support, it took a long time and a lot of negotiation.
You know, one of the things that I thought about when I saw the film, and I've watched it a few times now, and if you watch the film knowing about what happened, it hits you as a very powerful indictment. But this is different, I've noticed, in talking to some people who are very young or who are my age and didn't know about this for one reason or another. But the way it seems to hit those people is very different. You know, they basically, a number of people have expressed surprise at what they see as a kind of even-handed approach. Why did you choose to do it this way? I mean, I know, and it's not just they're seeing it, but you've talked about how you chose to do more an even-handed a presentation of things in a way that might seem even-handed to some people. To me, it didn't, but I thought it was because the truth was being let out of the bag, but, you know.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You know, one of the things they say is that the final step in making a documentary is showing it to real audiences, and then you finally understand the film you've made. And that's just really borne out for me. So I would agree with what you said, and I've been extremely interested to hear the perspectives and the different things that people read into the film. And it continues to grow as I talk to more audiences. And in some ways, I intended to make a film that worked very much in the full way that you described it, where people would be allowed and almost encouraged to draw conclusions for themselves, both about sort of what really happened, but as well as sort of what it meant and what it continued to mean, what it means today. You know, I wanted to make something where people could have that conversation and the conversation would sustain, that any point, that different points of view, sort of going in, any preconceived notion would be challenged, and coming out, any discussion would have a lot of food for thought and a lot of fodder. And that additionally, people would, yeah, just be allowed and encouraged to bring what they brought to it in terms of context. And that's played out in some ways that I expected and in some ways that have surprised me. And it's been really interesting and generative to see the film with audiences.
Well, one of the things that came through to me really forcefully in terms of the way, even the whole buildup to the eventual, you know, assault on the Move House on Osage Avenue, going all the way back to 76 through 78, all of this stuff, you know, you actually, by allowing the police and the various authorities to speak and just doing whatever and all of their arrogance and all of their whatever, shiftiness, whatever, you know, it really became sort of, it crystallized for me sort of that old, give them enough rope and they'll take care of the job themselves.
I believe in that philosophy as well, you know, let everyone have their turn, you know, try to present it. And sometimes we talked about the film like, almost like a presentation of evidence or I used to think about it, it's like I was going to tell you a story and I was just going to tell it to you by popping in videotape after videotape to assemble a story for you. So yeah, I'm glad it works. I mean, I think there's a wide range. One of the things I've started to find interesting is people actually identify with different people in the story. So sometimes I have to really ask people for more context in their question. Like I've gotten a question in the Q&A where someone says, I'll let you guess the demographics of the person, but they say, what would you have done? And I say, what would I have done if I were who? And they're like, what would you have done if you were the authorities? What would you have done when faced with this challenge? And I realize this person has gone through the whole film, not necessarily identifying with Move or Michael Ward, who I tend to identify with, but in fact, identifying with the authorities and thinking about if you were in a position of power, how would you deal with this situation that was so challenging? And I find that just extremely interesting and telling, that you actually follow different people through the story, depending on how you interpret it.
And it's interesting because towards the end of the story, you actually pose things in a way that really challenges people who might have that view. When you do that very short piece involving the cop that went in and rescued Michael Ward, Birdie Africa at the time, went in and rescued him when he was trying to escape from the house. And in the face of like what only, I mean, I presume to be, you know, incredible personal danger to himself and given what, you know, like as that reverend asked, why would people run out of the house and then decide on their own to go back into the blazing fire, in the blazing inferno? Why would they do that short of being threatened by the police and their rifles? And the whole point that this cop made a decision that he was going to risk everything to save Birdie Africa. And he came to that point where epistemology meets morality and had to do something. And then the payment he got after that, which was very horrendous. I mean, when you think about it, just the idea that he would walk in and there would be spray painted or written across his locker, "Nigger Lover," you know, just incredible. Yeah. It gives you a sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks volumes. I mean, no good deed goes unpunished. And thank you. I mean, I agree. I do see James Burkhauer's story in that light, and I sort of see, you know, I see all the rest of the cops almost like plastic soldiers, right? Like stuck in their boots, like unable to be a human and only being a cop. And I see him sort of like ripping his feet up and being like, no, I'm a human being. I make decisions. You know what I mean? I make judgment calls. This is wrong. I will say I've watched it with audiences that overtly reject that and say he was still part of the power structure and no one gets off easy. And they don't see the value in that because they come to it from such a strong sort of anti-system perspective. So there's room for that, too. You know, you don't have to believe him. Not everyone does.
We're talking with Jason Osder, the director of the film Let the Fire Burn, which is about the horrific, savage murder of the members of the Move organization in Philadelphia in 1985 by the Philadelphia police and the Philadelphia authorities. Jason, I have to tell you, I'm one of those people that has a really strong, well, I'll put it this way. I'm a revolutionary communist, so you can't get a stronger perspective in terms of get rid of this system. But I think the point that around with this cop actually is much more to me. It says a lot more about what's the role of police in society. And if some cop wants to go against that, the choice he has to make is he going to do what's right or isn't he? If he does what's right, he can no longer be a cop. That's a pretty heavy situation there.
You know, and on both sides, you know, there's a beauty to Move's philosophy in terms of identifying the system in that way and identifying, in essence, their social analysis is so relevant to that cop. He can't actually be, like, the system chews him up and spits him out. And it's exactly the system that Move is talking about. You know what I mean? So it kind of comes full circle, and it's philosophically complex, I hope.
Well, let me ask you this. The demonization of Move. I want to talk about that a little bit because the role of the press has always been a big question. And the fact that Move, from the very beginning, has been demonized. And in Philadelphia, there was always a long history. I mean, that it wasn't just, it wasn't like Rizzo had beef with the Panthers. He did. Rizzo had beef with MOVE. He did. Rizzo was, you know, he was the head of the military enforcement squad for the system in Philadelphia. And then he became the mayor and he brought along all of his ideological and political stances. And he actually did concentrate something that was being unleashed in the nation at that time in relation to black people. And when he did all this attacking, and I was kind of curious, though, about the role of the press, you know, the major newspapers, the radio stations, you know, that kind of thing. That what happened there? It seemed like, I know there's one part where I read somewhere where there had, I think it might have been in Lynn Washington's stuff, some of the stuff that he wrote, who's a black journalist in Philadelphia and was there at the time. And he wrote about the fact that, and maybe you spoke about this too, the fact that the press kept looking for a way to characterize MOVE. And finally, just before the incident, they characterized them as what?
Terrorists is what you're referring to, right? Yeah. That actually comes, I read that analysis personally. It might be other places, but I personally read that analysis in a book by an academic who at the time was at Penn and I think still lives in Philadelphia, but maybe works somewhere else. And she wrote a very, very academic communication studies book about the incident. And she did textual analysis on the newspapers. And that was her conclusion, not based on, like, actually based on counting the words, right, that they struggled, that they were all over the place for the years and months leading up. But as they got closer and closer, the words congealed around the word terrorist, which is so interesting, especially to think that it was 1985. And then, you know, yeah, to speak to Rizzo, to me, only a little sliver of it is actually in my film, what you're talking about. You know, there's so much to the history of how he built that police department. And then I think it really speaks to the nature of power, because as easy as it is to demonize Rizzo, and rightfully, you know, I mean, he was, by any standards, a bad guy. In 78, he went to the scene, he held a bullhorn, he was mayor, but he commanded the troops, and one of his guys got shot, and all the kids came out of the house alive. And then, sort of, I feel like the head is cut off the beast with his police force, right? Good becomes the first African-American mayor of the city, but he's not the same type of, he's a technocrat, basically. And sort of the head is put off the beast, and it's replaced with a new executive leader, but that next layer of lieutenants is still the same people that came up under Rizzo. And that's part of the dynamic that plays out in 1985.
Let me ask you this, Jason. You know, there's the all too familiar refrain that happens, and I think you've referred to it as we've been speaking today, but I think it's also in interviews I read that you did. And also, I just in thinking about it myself, there's that, and you pose it in the film some of the times, where actually you'll have different people saying, well, actually, you know, didn't MOVE sort of bring this on themselves? Don't they bear some responsibility for the massacre? Maybe not everything, but some responsibility. And I was thinking about this because you've posed the question that in making the film, you wanted people to really wrestle with big questions. And I think that I started to think about this really in particular in relation to Louise James and Laverne Sims,
two supporters of the MOVE organization,
and their really powerful statements those hearings. It squarely puts the blame on the police and the system. And if you think about this, the problems that arose between MOVE and the people in the neighborhood are really, they're contradictions among the people, and they can be solved way short of the kind of massacre that went on that. They can be resolved among the people themselves without the hand of the state ever even entering into it. But the contradiction between the military repressive apparatus of the system and the people was a whole other animal. And you think about this, the tens of thousands of rounds that were fired into various MOVE houses, the fact that the 9 people went to jail, that, you know, a baby was killed in 76, 9 people went to jail in 78 for supposedly killing a cop, but yet none of the guns they had in the house had fire pins in them. All of these things that went on, ending in the explosion at that, dropping the bomb on the house and then allowing the entire neighborhood to burn. This says something much bigger about what the hell is going on there, that it's much more than resentment or overreaction. You know, they did, after all, burn an entire neighborhood down and send a huge message with all that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a striking piece of history. And as you said earlier, it's striking that so few Americans know about it. I guess, you know, when you get down to some of the bigger questions or the morality or accountability, yeah, I think there's a lot of blame to go around, right? I think there's an awful lot of mistakes made. I think there's very little, nothing that justifies the actual ultimate overreach and overreaction of the police. But I guess in some of the analysis that bothers me, that I like to push back on, for instance, is You know, there's a school of thought in Philadelphia and elsewhere that if something was necessary, maybe not that, they sort of got what they deserved, this sort of thing. And my basic response to that is, I don't think they're blameless, but I think any analysis that lumps together the adults in the house with the children in the house is really morally problematic. Because it's one thing to be an activist and be an adult, right? And to make decisions to stand against the system and stand for your political rights. And there's no doubt it's a horrible human rights violation, what ultimately happens. But politically, if you made that choice, you understood at some level the stakes as an adult. That's wholly different than a child like Michael Ward that grew up in it his whole life, was born into it, joined it at age two, right? And it's a whole different moral calculus. So I think the adults in the house had some, well, let's put it this way, if you slice it fine, they certainly are further on the spectrum of accountability than the children in the house, who are at the far end of having no control, no agency in the situation. Yep. I think everyone who is an adult in the city sort of has some culpability that day.
We're talking with Jason Osder, the director of the film Let the Fire Burn, which is about the horrific, savage murder of the members of the MOVE organization in Philadelphia in 1985 by the Philadelphia police and the Philadelphia authorities. And it's a really, really great film, well worthwhile seeing it a couple of times. Now, Jason, just to pursue this a little bit more, you know, because I think, look, this question of, you know, responsibility, I mean, we're living in an era where we're being told, we're being hit time and time again from every different angle that somehow black people are responsible for their own oppression, for what happens to them. This is from Bill Cosby saying, if these kids would just pull up their damn pants, they wouldn't go to jail. Or Barack Obama saying, if black people hadn't squandered all the gains that they got, you know, then they'd be in a better off, they'd be in a better situation. That, you know, his speech at the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. And this, you know, but to me, the big question that you posed, and it's interesting, you know, that talking with you about it now is, you know, I'd have to ask you, you know, even regardless of whether it was the adults who were in the house and what they were doing and their political messages, you know, blasting of the, you know, the idea that some people said they were provoking the police, blasting the neighborhood, they were provoking the neighborhood, you know, people, and they were, you know, just making it impossible for people to live their leisurely life. Well, you know, here's the thing, and leisurely is not meant as an insult there, but just sort of that life of, you know, I don't have to pay attention to nonsense when I come home from work. And the thing is that is there anything at all that a group of people, adult or children, could do that would warrant tens of thousands of bullets, bombs, fires, jail, killings? Is there anything at all? And the scene in the alley where the children were trying to come out of the building and they ran back in. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation about what the police that were back in that alley, the firing at that stuff, the gunshots heard. So my question to you is there really anything at all that anybody in MOVE could have done that would somehow have justified the horror that was unleashed on them?
No, I mean, I'm not saying that at all. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that at all. But what I would say is that I think what's incumbent on us is to look at the present and look at the future and ask where this continues to happen. Ask where are people being dehumanized in this way? Where is violence being done on people now, today, without any regard for their humanity? And the differentiation I was trying to make is about the children. Where are children being used? Where are the beliefs of adults causing children with no control of their lives to be sacrificed? And I think, you know, I think there are examples that we see today, especially overseas, where the same sort of hands off, let's drop the bomb from as high as possible and run away, and if there's some collateral damage, so be it. I think we see that all the time. And I think that's where...
I really welcome your point there. I mean, this is going to be my last question because just to talk about it, I read something in relation to the film that referenced William Faulkner's observation that the past isn't even the past in this country. Yes. And it seems to be very much the case when you look at what you've revealed in your film, which again, I think is like really, really stunning. And it has you churning for days after you see it. And, you know, you really have to examine the biggest possible questions about what do you do in the face
of massive criminality, you know, and what I'm referring to is to this, that's being put done by the system. You know, it's sort of similar to what do you do in the face of like the trains going to, you know, the concentration camps in Nazi Germany during World War II. This is the point, you know, and this point about it, the past not being the past. You think about Katrina, what happened there. You think about mass incarceration, the rampant police murder that's constantly just ruled justifiable homicide. This is the kind of stuff. And then the drone attacks in Pakistan, as you're saying. This is the, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to say that two things really. Just like I wanted to encourage people to sort of really bring themselves and bring their own context, I wanted people to encourage people in terms of what it means or what happened, also in terms of where this, right, this question. And the things that resonate so much with me are New Orleans and the incident at the bridge, right? And there seemed to be just a strong connection there with, you know, two cities, fire and water, and these two incidents, police and black people. I mean, that just seemed to be such a resonant comparison. And then, yeah, the drone war seems so resonant. But what I really want to say is because the film doesn't place itself in our present, it places itself in 1985's present, you know, I fear that it will continue to be relevant, right? So that even I've seen this over the couple years it's been coming out, that at different incidents people say, oh, it reminds me of this that's going on right now. And I suspect, unless we really do a great job, you know, fixing a lot of social justice problems, that in 5 or 10 years, people will watch this and say, oh, it reminds me of this piece of injustice that's going on now, today, but it's our future. And that's sort of a sad thing to say about, I mean, it's a good thing to say about the film, I suppose, but it's a sad thing to say about the state of society because it does keep happening.
Yeah, and I lied. One more point. You know, in reference to all of this, you know, he made a point about something that I thought was really interesting. I kind of laughed when I first read it, and I thought, wait a minute, this is actually very heavy. You said that in relation to the hearings and using the hearings, that when people said, well, they were kind of bothered, or they saw, look, those officials there, they were all lying, they were doing all this stuff, and you said, actually, what bothered you more than that was that they were, in fact, telling the truth. And what the hell does that say about how black people are viewed in America today?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very revealing, it's some parts of it are very revealing, and it is, yeah, in fact, that the ultimate verdict here was, yes, this was acceptable. Like, no one, you know, there were no charges, right? Like, the ultimate verdict of our whole, of the system, right, the very same system that Move talks about, was that this gets a pass, as do a number of the things that we've been talking about. The parallels also get a pass, usually. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, just recently, the incident we were just discussing about New Orleans got a pass. So, yeah, it's I'm glad that it resonates in this way. You know, I think that you tell a story about the past so that it can help inform our present. And as I said, one of the things that's what you're trying to do. Right. That's the design. That's the theory. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, some of that you do it for so many years and you write on these, you know, applications and stuff. You know, it'll be provocative and it'll initiate difficult discussions that are still relevant today. And it's nice to see it actually happen. Do you know what I mean? And sometimes it works even better. You know, you spend all this time sort of setting up the dominoes, and then you finally kick them off and show people. And they react sometimes even better or more telling than you expect.
Yep. All right, Jason. On that note, I want to thank you very much for the film and for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate being here.
Okay, take care.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, that was Jason Osdor, the director of Let the Fire Burn. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with my interview with the late Jose Montoya, poet extraordinaire. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Pachuco from Maldita Vecindad.
And I'm sure Jose Montoya, the subject of our next segment of our show, would have deeply appreciated that song being dedicated to him. All right? Jose Montoya. Jose Montoya was someone who was known as the father of Chicano poetry, and he was a man who dedicated his life and his work and his art to telling the story of the Chicano people and bringing it out to the world. Well, Jose died on September 25th of this year, and as I thought about that, I really wanted to do a special segment of the show just honoring Jose, and so I dug back into that big box of old shows and found an interview I did with Jose Montoya back in 2007. And this interview occurred just before he was being honored for his lifetime's work in telling the stories of the Chicano people, in fighting against the dehumanization and the degradation of the people, and insisting on their fullest humanity and showing that humanity in his art. And I could think of no other better way to say goodbye to Jose than to let you hear this interview that I did back, maybe 6 years ago now. And I'm sure you'll enjoy it as much as I did when I did it. So this is my interview with Jose Montoya, a giant among poets. Jose, welcome to the show.
How you doing, bro?
Good, man. It's been a while since I've seen you. I think the last time I saw you was when Culture Clash was doing Culture Clash in America, or they were doing a Berkeley show up there.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to let people know that, you know, for people who don't know, that you are one of the people without whom there really wouldn't be Chicano poetry on the level or on in the way that there is today, that you really forged a whole view, a whole worldview, a whole outlook on that. And I wanted to, you know, ask you, what led you to do that? What inspired you to do that?
Well, I think that, having had, I don't know if we can say it's a benediction or a malediction, but I was born right at the end of the Depression, the Great Depression. So I grew up in that milieu of the Depression and then the Dust Bowl from northern New Mexico up northeastern New Mexico. So we were affected by the same drought that drove people out of Oklahoma and Arkansas, and our trek from those mountains in New Mexico was first to Albuquerque, and there wasn't much happening there, so we made it somehow to Califas, where they were looking for people to work in the fields. The Japanese had been put away in relocation camps. All of the raza in the valley had gone to the shipyard works in the coast, which were paying more money, so they were looking for people to work in the fields, and they used to send these renganches to places like New Mexico and Texas, Denver, Colorado, to bring people, and that's how we began to move out of that comfort zone for me, even though it was pretty bleak. The times were very, very difficult for us, but things began to brighten up as we were put on trains and brought to Califas and the Central Valley and Delano. And so my life began in Califas as a farm worker. I grew up in that milieu. And then during the Korean War, I graduated from high school, and I got in a little trouble, and my judge gave me a choice of joining the Marines or going to road camp, and I knew what that was all about, so I tried the Marines, and they wouldn't take me because I had a cross tattooed on my hand, you know, kind of being the baby Chooks from the Pachuco época, and that was already a gang sign that said, don't take these guys in the Navy or the Air Force or the Marines, but somehow I guess the Navy needed. I went across the hall, and the guy in the Navy recruiter didn't even look in my hands. He just signed me up. So I wound up going to Korea, coming back, and using that education to really expand my mind about things that I was interested in. And one was, this excitement that I saw in coming from New Mexico, working in the fields and all of that. I wanted to put that down. I wanted to write about it. I never thought about poetry, because poetry in the schools, well, we really, there wasn't much poetry going on in MR classes, which is where they used to put us when we didn't, weren't able to read or speak English. And although we thought we were doing okay, but I guess there still was a special program for us. So it wasn't until I was in Korea that I read a Tortilla Flats by John Steinbeck, and I really got mad at the way that he was treating barrio people. And that stayed with me, so that when I came out of the Navy and I was able to go to school in one of the English classes, I recognized that name, and we were given an option to write papers on this names on the blackboard, and I spotted this same vato that I had felt really did a number on raza in his book Tortilla Flat. And so that's how I got into Steinbeck. And once I read the rest of the things that Steinbeck wrote and stood for, I thought that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write about the plight of the Chicano people.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is an interview I did with Jose Montoya, the father of Chicano poetry, who died back in September 25th of this year. And this interview was conducted in 2007. Now, you, in doing that, and there's a couple things I wanted to talk about. First, I'll say this. One of the things that seems to have shaped you, as you mentioned, the whole, you know, the idea that, and I know I've read this a couple times where you've referred to yourself, where you said, look, I was a pachuco. You know, and it seems, and you're probably the poem of yours that's been anthologized more than any has been El Louis.
Right.
And can you tell people a little bit about what that is and, you know, what you were saying with that?
Well, El Louis was an extraordinary young man in the San Joaquin Valley in the little town of Fowler. And he was extraordinary because he didn't have much of an education, but somehow he was able to excite the rest of us about the things that were out there beyond the fields. And he was quite an impressive vato. And he was older than the rest of us, just a little bit younger than my older brother Jimmy, who was a pachuco. And Louis was still, we considered him to be, a pachuco. And so he kind of took his brothers and myself and the rest of the young people there in Fowler and got us to become excited about things like education and things like he was very much, what's the word I'm looking for? He was interested in outer space. This guy was talking about how that there'd come a day when we go to dances in the moon, like we go to dances in Hanford or Five Points, you know. So we looked up to him. He went into that war, came out, and he was never the same again, although. So it became a real tragic thing for the rest of us to watch, but we never wanted to diminish, you know, his lessons and his presence and who he was as a persona.
And it really had a lot to do, too, it seems, with the idea that, you know, really going against, I mean, if you think about what was going on and the demonization of pachucos then and what it's like with cholos and cholas now and what it's like with black youth now and, you know, the kids that get, you know, hooked up in the gangs and whatnot, and even kids that are in hip-hop, you know, just for wearing baggy pants and big shirts, you know, and there's a demonization that you seem to be really speaking out against in that, and in a way that really grabbed people's hearts. I mean, it's a very powerful poem, really an incredible poem. Is there any chance you'll be doing that Saturday night?
Well, I'm not sure what I'm doing there. I was told that I was in being honored that I didn't have to do anything but sit and watch people.
You know, I'm going to be in the front row, Jose, and I'm going to demand that you do something.
Somebody says, you know, we carry our satchels everywhere we go, man, because we never know when we're going to be asked to pull something out.
There you go. Now, let me ask you this, because one of the things you also, one of the hallmarks of your art is not only the mixing of genres, but that you also have this real push around language. And you in particular, you've written in, and I, you know, I'm trying to remember what the style that it's been called. Is it Kahlo writing?
Kahlo.
Kalo. You know, and it's, and could you explain to people what that is and why it was important to do that kind of writing and those kinds of voices, even the syntax, the back and forth between Spanish and English? What was it hard to do that, and why was it important to do that?
Well, I think that's how we grew up, you know, and the more we came in contact with the English language, the more we took from it, and but we never relinquished any of the things that were ours, and it became very easy to switch back and forth. It was never a problem. It so that was one of the ways that we could you know, get around our parents. You know, they speak in Spanish and they didn't understand English, so we would speak in English and back and forth. That was the reason for that, or how that came about. The jargon of the Pachucada, I was, you know, at that impressionable age, 12 or 13, I was a shine boy for the these vatos that got all decked out. And they were impressive. I mean, it could have been, you know, my, you know, something to look up to. But so we picked up on their language, and we picked up on how they dressed, and the curiosity of where does the language come from. A lot of the Kalo that I remember being passed around in the barrio was coming from the first bracero, bunch that came to Califas. There were some braceros that came directly from La Capirucha, from Mexico City. And these vatos spoke a language that, that to us sounded very exciting. You know, everything had a different name. Tramaos for pants and calcos for shoes. And I guess my own affinity to curiosity compelled me to want to know where they got that language. How did they come about? And I'm sure I wasn't being scientific you know, what's the word I'm using here? I wasn't coming from academia. I was just a curious kid wanting to know why they called calcos, or why they called shoes calcos. And a lot of the best information that I got was that this was language that was brought to Mexico by the itineraries of the bullfighters, and these were mostly gypsy gitanos that, that were attached to these famous bullfighters that came to Mexico, and they felt the only comfortable place that they felt at home was like in Tepito or Lagunilla, the marketplaces. And they had this language, and a lot of the vatos that came from Mexico around that time brought that language with them. And so that Kalo became something that the Chucos picked up as a way of having a language for this persona that was now somewhere in the middle. It wasn't... It wasn't New York boogie woogie. It wasn't Mexico City. It was right here in the barrios. And whether it was in Albuquerque or in Fresno, I saw the same things happening to young people. I was impressed with all that, and as I began to polish my writing, I thought that I needed to shed some light on that epoch.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is an interview I did with Jose Montoya, the father of Chicano poetry, who died back in September 25th of this year. And this interview was conducted in 2007. Now, I have one question left to ask you here, because we are, actually, as much as I said we were going to try and avoid the constraints of time, we actually are constrained somewhat by time. But I wanted to actually ask you this, because I've read something where you know, one of the things that people should know, I mean, you've been from the you know, moment you started writing almost. I mean, you had this idea of, actually, you've talked about in some things, some statements I've seen from you, you've said, you know, that you had to go against, and I'm sure, you know, the establishment, the poetry establishment, the way that the page poets, the academics, the whole idea that you would write in Spanish and English was actually something that that would be an alternate, and it was something that you had to probably you had to go against convention to be able to push out there. But it was something that the people loved, as you're indicating. And there was something. There's also something here too, though, that you said. I read something where you said, "Look, we used the language that the schools didn't understand, and that our folks would pull their hair out trying to understand what you were talking about." But you also, you know, link that up to today, and I should tell people you were the poet laureate of the city of Sacramento, and you spent a lot of time of your career in poetry, your dedication to poetry and the other art forms, music and painting, to not just, you know, sort of a random portrayal, but actually to digging in and carrying and making it, building it as part of a struggle for the humanity of Chicano people. And you continue today around this question of the youth. And I was really moved by this thing you were saying with the language, because you said, look, today I think it's really important to move the youth. And I was a teenager once, so I know the anguish. I know the battleground. Can we talk about that a little bit, the importance of the youth?
Well, yeah, I think that we were at the forefront of picking up all this ways of talking and expressing oneself, and as we grew with it and as we began to paint or write or do music, we wanted that to be respected. We wanted to bring it in, even though it was condemned by our parents, it was condemned by the school, it was condemned by the police. We were immediately kind of targets, and to me that was all. That always seemed to be so... it was very unfair, and so it was exciting to bring to be able to one day say, look, whatever it was that we did for our language, apparently it's valuable. There's people getting PhDs writing about it. So we stuck with it, and I'm glad that we did, and I continue to be astonished at how that young generation of today, they're taking it into some totally different areas and doing great stuff, beautiful stuff with it, and still the condemnation never stops. So it's always an uphill battle.
Is there, now I don't want to put you on the spot, but I will. And if you don't have anything to do, then you can just tell me and we'll move on. But is there a short piece you could do to give people a taste of your work?
Well, you know, I would like to select a piece that I have just in the last few years put together. And the irony is that my background and my jacket or record or whatever you want to call it was mild compared to what some of the other carnales went through, but it reached a point where respectability allowed me to get a college professorship, and I taught University of Sacramento for I don't know how many years. This poem that I want to read is something that I got involved in about 20 years ago with a circle of men who came together to try and see how we could help the carnales that seem to be always prone to going to drugs or going to prisons. And so we began to work with addicts and batterers, violence, domestic violence types, and alcoholics 20 years ago. And in those 20 years, we've also picked up along the way the youth and where they're coming from. And they're in these programs because, you know, something went wrong somewhere along the line, but it was never something that we saw as being necessarily negative. They just have to channel energies into areas that put them in positions where they got in trouble. But we've worked now for 20 years, and the most impressive bunch that I can see to this day are the young gangbangers that we brought into the program and how they changed and where they're at now. And they actually introduced us, old Rucos, you know, to a whole nother way of seeing who we are as Chicano people and what our connection is say, to our indigenous side of who we are. Not just the fact that this is a, you know, America and the land of the free and all that, we know better. But that group that we brought in about 7 to 10 years ago that are now college graduates, they're counselors, they got an incredible record. So I want to read this. It's not a long poem, okay. So if you'll bear with me.
Sure.
And it's called El Círculo. It could not have been any other way. It could not have been anything else. It had to be the circle to heal hell. We all came to it ailing, unwashed, and the survivors in 20 years were rewarded, and we witnessed 4 generations receive the medicine emanating, radiating from that focus, up, down, and the 4 directions. Powerful. Group 1, the elders, aging, nursing blown prostates and liver damage, slipping and sliding, but clean. Group 2, clean, but ravages of past abuse taking toll, yet remain stellar role models for Group 3, the gangbangers facing 1 more strike, now saved, clean, and agile. Metamorphosing jaguars, fire tenders and willow cutters, and singers of large songs, saving generation 4. Now coming to the circle straight from middle school, grandfather. We couldn't all be saved, but group 3 impressed us all. Earth, water, wind, and fire came together for them, for us, for all. Oh, Mateo. So that's 20 years of working in the trenches and seeing how it's possible to bring the youngsters out of there and into a positive thing that returns to us the riches that are ours and belong to us.
All right, Jose, thank you very much for
that. Okay, brother.
And I'll see you. I look forward to seeing you Saturday night down at LATC.
Okay.
All right, you've just been listening to an interview I did back in 2007 with Jose Montoya, a giant among poets and a man who many consider the father of Chicano poetry. Jose died in September of this year, and this was a tribute to him, to his life, and to his work. All right, well, this just about brings us to the end of yet another edition of The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Nellish Lalani. I also want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And some words to live by as you're walking through this really screwed up world. Never forget, you're looking for answers, go to revcom.us. We're going to go out now with a little bit more of Pachuco from Maldita Vecindad. No sé cómo se atreven a...